There was food enough to meet even Kulingile's appetite, which they saw properly satisfied for the first time at last when he had eaten a heap of fresh caught fish, nearly the full size of his body. And in a smaller and more personal vein, there was something near paradise in finding, after so long and grinding a journey, so civilized and gracious a welcome, familiar, even if foreign. But this same gratitude could not but make Lawrence all the more sensible of the very real danger of conflict which this outpost represented. It was not merely the presence of the Chinese, or their cooperation with the native Larikia. 2 days after their arrival, several Macassan praus appeared in the harbour, come to harvest Trepang. Shortly their small flotilla of canoes were plying the coast, Malay divers plunging from their sides over and over, and in the evening bringing in their haul to be counted up and prepared. Enormous vats of boiling seawater stood on bonfires, and after boiling the Trepang were hauled out and laid upon frames in huge dark ranks for drying in the intense heat of the sun. Apart from this freshly gathered haul, the divers brought up also from time to time pearls. To these the native tribesmen had the supply of opals and heaps of dried spices to exchange for Chinese goods. The market which was forming among them might be small only for being so new and for the limitations of the harbour, but it was taking shape with remarkable speed. Jia had set aside all the southern wing of the building for their use and comfort. It was not adequate to the full size of their party, but the lower officers and the convicts put up light tents upon the ground behind the building, as yet undeveloped, and so filled out their shelter. The building was in a light, unfamiliar style, well suited to the humid and tropical climate, allowing the winds to bring coolness through the thin walls. The men were certainly in no great hurry to leave. Four had fallen sick, and Lawrence felt himself strangely enervated, the natural urgency of so extraordinary a discovery deadened by fatigue and by the peculiar and isolated circumstances. Their return journey would devour another 2 months almost certainly, and then whatever intelligence they might send would require 6 more at the least to reach any authority who might act. A full day's idleness seemed without meaning when matched against such stretches of dead time, and almost difficult to avoid when so abruptly they had been relieved of the necessity, or even the opportunity, to fend for their own care. One after another unspooled into a week, and when they had only begun to settle it that they must shortly depart, Jia interrupted their plans by visiting to invite them formally to a banquet, to be held at the night of the new moon, a week hence. The invitation could not be refused, after so much generosity on the part of their hosts, and so much slothfulness on their own. To suddenly find it necessary to leave at once could only be, it seemed to Lawrence, the height of rudeness.
"I scarcely see how it could be more suitable to attend some barbaric feast," Rankin said, "given by encroaching agents of a foreign power, likely soon to be at odds with our government and undermining our trade. But certainly we will wait if you insist upon it," he finished, with cool sarcasm. "And a pretty figure I am sure you will cut on the occasion."
"We are pretty ragged," Granby said. "But I suppose that is better than behaving like a Rudesby. I don't see you saying no when they are offering you dinner and bringing a tunny for your beast."
"At the least," Lawrence said to Temeraire afterwards privately, "the intimacy of such an occasion may prove an opportunity to broach the subject of their position here, the awkwardness such a situation must produce between our nations."
"I do not at all see why," Temeraire said. "We have come so dreadfully far, Lawrence. Whatever can it matter to anyone in Sydney that the Chinese are here? And it must be very pleasant for us," he added, "to at least have the opportunity of visiting, if we like to make the journey. And Mr. Jia has already very kindly informed me that if I should like to send letters, he feels it quite his office to send them express. He sees no reason that Long Shun Li should not visit us even in Sydney to deliver them, when that should be convenient. I have shown her our valley on the map. She does not think it would be more than a week out of her way, flying from Uluru, so she can manage it now and again."
"Uluru?" Lawrence asked.
"The Great Rock," Temeraire said. "Where we saw her. That is where they deliver goods to the Pichanjachara, who have been sending them onwards to the other tribes. It is easy to make out from aloft. I suppose she might also bring some goods to Sydney herself," he added, quite the opposite sort of encouragement which the British government should have liked.
Lawrence was determined to make some attempt, however. This outpost was new enough, and the market yet so small that it might not be an entrenched enterprise. Some agreement might be found, some compromise, if he could understand better the purpose of the settlement, and it occurred to him in a dawning hope that if Jeer would forward letters, he might send one also to Arthur Hammond, the envoy established in Peking, who had negotiated the treaty which had left Temeraire in British hands and secured them certain advantages in the single open port of Canton.
"If we could not rely on the letters remaining secure and unread," Lawrence said, "at least it would not take the better part of a year to arrive, and I suppose I would trust Hammond's sense of the situation better than ours."
"Better than Whitehall's also," Granby said, and looked at Tharkey. "Unless you know more of that than we do."
Tharkey shrugged noncommittally. Lawrence struggled to form some plan of attack, some approach not hideously clumsy in execution, and to further complicate the matter he would have to rely on Temeraire to translate, as his own Chinese was a limited mess and half forgotten. The occasion could only be uncomfortable. It must seem in some sense almost a threat, or at least interference. Lawrence thought it nearly certain he should give offence, and to gentlemen who could not resent it, very nearly the worst solecism he could imagine for his own part. But he had in some sense an obligation to both parties, which demanded the effort of reconciliation. However inadequate he might be to the task, he and Temeraire at least were present, and there was no better interlocutor to be had. Certainly the government would likely wish to challenge the encroachment on Britain's trade, if not the mere existence of what might be termed a colony, although the Chinese seemed less particularly interested in peopling the territory than in forming relations with the native tribesmen, and profiting by the extension of their trade. China's strength was in her aerial forces, but one lightweight dragon, or even four, if all the other of Longshan Li's breed were brought hence, could not withstand the full force of a British naval expedition, nor modern weaponry, if brought to bear against them. But all concerns Lawrence might have had, and all his planning, were by the next morning overturned. On the tide a small fleet of vessels began to come into the harbour. More of the Macassan prows, armed with their narrow, sleek canoes, but these bringing in great heaps of ripe tropical fruit, and carved wooden vessels to be carefully unloaded onto the shore and added to the other stores already under shelter. Several seeming officers of this company were met with some ceremony upon the shore and invited into the other quarters of the house, and Lawrence realized belatedly that the dinner would not be a private event, as Gong Su came and asked if he might offer his assistance with the burgeoning preparations. Jia was now quite unavailable for any private conference either, consumed with attentions to his rapidly increasing number of guests. The next morning, Lawrence woke and saw in the harbour a launch rowing to the jetty from a neat little merchant sloop of 6 guns, an American, and a Dutch vessel came in on the next tide in the evening.
"The flow of goods to Sydney begins to look incidental," Tharkey observed.
By the evening of the dinner, a Portuguese bark had joined the increasing throng, and without wishing to play the spy, Lawrence had seen some dozen small and heavy chests brought onto shore, carefully, and set into the Dragon Pavilion under guard, almost certainly coinage, and in enough quantity, judging by the size, to pay for holds full of silk and porcelain and tea. Where these goods were to come from, however, Lawrence did not see.